Chapters of Life by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 5, Painting with Words. The ancient gray walls gleamed whitely under the harvest moon, throwing deep black shadows across the well-raked gravel of the drive. Old indeed it was, and mellow with the love which is bestowed upon well-loved things. From a wall facing moonwards, an antique coat of arms proudly caught the moonbeams and tossed them back in age-faded colors. From the mullioned windows came the yellow gleam of electric light. The old hall was gay tonight, gay with the joy that comes only to a betrothal so recently announced. The moon sailed serenely across the luminous sky. The shadows marched slowly across the open spaces, turning the side trees to the darkest ebony. A sudden burst of music and golden light as French windows opened and a young man and woman stepped out on the terraced balcony. Behind them, the windows closed silently. Hand in hand, the man and woman crossed to the stone balustrade and gazed out upon the peaceful scene before them. A vagrant breeze blew the gentle scent of mimosa to them. Tenderly placing his arm around the woman's waist, the man walked with her to the broad marble steps leading to the close-cropped lawn. He was tall and clad in some uniform with the buttons and badges flashing in the moonlight. She was dark-haired and with ivory skin which so often comes to such people. Her evening gown was long and almost of the color of the moon itself. Slowly they walked across the lawn to join a tree-lined path. Infrequently they stopped a moment and gazed at each other. Soon they came to a rustic wooden bridge crossing a placid stream. For a time they leaned on one of the rails of the bridge, murmuring softly to each other, gazing at their reflection on the unruffled waters below. Resting her head on the man's shoulder, the woman pointed upwards to a hoot owl, staring intently down from a great oak tree. Unhappy at being watched, the bird spread great wings and soared off across the garden. The man and woman straightened and strolled on, past well-tended bushes, past flowers now folded in sleep. Ever and anon, small rustles and squeaks showed that the little people of the night went about their legitimate business. The path curved and widened and turned into a well-kept strand. The moonlight shed a broad white band across the softly heaving water. Tiny wavelets caught the light and turned it into a myriad of glittering jewels dancing on the water. A mile away, a huge white liner clove her stately path through the sea, decks ablaze with lights. From her came faintly the strains of music as her band entertained the dancing couples on the decks. The red of her portside light gleamed, and floodlights lit up the house mark on her funnels. Phosphorescent foam came from the meeting of her bows with the water, and waves from her wake gurgled and tumbled upon the beach. The man and woman, arms about each other, stood and watched the majestic progress. Soon she was hull down, and no more could the strains of her music be heard. In the velvet purple dimness cast by the shade of a tall pine tree, they stood together, telling each other only the things that lovers tell, planning the future, looking forward to life itself. No shadow crossed the moon. The air was warm and balmy. Gently the little wavelets tickled the rounder pebbles and played with the smaller sand. The night beneath the harvest moon was made for lovers, a night for poets too, for are not poems the essence of dreams and life? The sands of the desert were searing hot beneath the blazing heat of the noonday sun. Even Mother Nile, flowing between hard-baked banks, seemed more sluggish than usual, with the heat vapor pouring off her gleaming bosom and losing water which an arid land could so ill afford. Unlucky fellaheen, condemned to work in the fields under the torrid sky, moved with heavy lethargy, too hot and weary to even curse the sweltering day. An ibis bird stood drooping by a clump of wilting reeds. The new tombs of the great ones stood bright and tall, with the heat drying the freshly placed mortar between the immense blocks and capping stones. In the relative coolness of the embalming room, deep beneath the burning sands, a wizened old man and his scarcely younger assistant worked as they stuffed aromatic herbs into a month's dead body. "I reckon the pharaoh is taking strong measures against the priest," said the more ancient of the two. "Yes," replied the other with gloomy satisfaction. "I saw the guards raiding some of the temples, arresting some and cautioning others, and carrying out bales of papyri. They looked very determined, too." "I don't know what the world is coming to," said the ancient. "Never was like this in my younger days. The world is going to pot, that's what it is, going to pot." Sighing and mumbling, he picked up his packing rod and rammed more herbal mixture into an orifice of the unprotesting corpse. "By order of the pharaoh," shouted the captain of the guard, as, surrounded by his men, he stalked majestically into the quarters of the high priest. "You are accused of harboring malcontents who plot against him, and try to cast evil spells that they may harm him." Turning to his men, he gave the order, "Search the place, seize all the papyri." The high priest sighed and quietly remarked, "It was ever thus. Those who aspire to higher learnings are persecuted by ignorant men who fear to know the truth and who think that no one can know more than they. So in destroying our papers of wisdom, you extinguish the rushlights of knowledge." The day was a hard one, with soldiers on the alert, guards raising and carrying off suspects, most often those who had been betrayed through a neighbor's spite. Slave-drawn carts rumbled through the streets, laden with confiscated papyri. But the day ended, as days always have and always will, no matter how endless they seem, to suffering victims of oppression. A cool breeze sprang up and rustled the papyrus reeds with a dry, grating sound. Small waves bounded across the dimming Nile to rebound from the sun-baked sands. Along the lower reaches of the river, ferrymen smiled with pleasure as their slatting sails filled with wind and sped them upon their homeward path. Free from the torrid heat of the day, small creatures emerged from holes in the bank and began their nightly prowl in search of prey. But humans were in search of prey, too. The dark vault of the heavens was besprinkled with the shining jewels, which were the stars. Tonight, the moon would be late in rising. Faint glimmers of light came from mud huts, and scarce brighter gleams came from the homes of the wealthy. The air was filled with terror, foreboding. No roisterer loitered on the streets this night. No lovers clasped hands and made promises by the broad sweep of the Nile. Tonight the Pharaoh's men prowled the streets, heavy-footed and coarse of mien, ready for sport. The purge was on, a purge against the scholars, the priests, and any who might threaten the Pharaoh by forecasting his early demise. It was death to be abroad this night, death on the pikes of the prowling guards. But in the dark places of the city, silent figures lurked and flitted from shadow to deeper shadow as the Pharaoh's men clumped noisily by. Gradually a pattern became apparent. Silent, determined men, using every available cover in order to reach their destination unchallenged. As the guards patrolled noisily and the eternal stars wheeled overhead, dark figure after dark figure slipped easily through an unmarked, unlighted door, slipped through to be seized by those behind the door and held securely until identity was established. As the last man insinuated his silent way in and was identified, waiting men placed great bulks of timber against the door to ensure that it was firm. An ancient, cracked voice wavered, "Follow me, let each man in line place a hand on the shoulder of the man in front, follow me, and no noise, for death stalks us tonight." With the merest suspicion of a shuffling sound, the line of men followed their leader down through a well-concealed trap door. Down, down the slanting path for a long, long way, and at last they emerged in an old burial vault where the air lay dank and musty. "We shall be safe here," whispered the old leader, "but let us not unduly raise our voices, lest the minions of Set hear us and carry tidings of our meeting." Silently, they filed round and placed themselves among the funeral furniture. Squatting on their heels, they waited in expectation for their leader's words. The old man peered short-sightedly around the gathering, assessing, weighing, and at last he said, "We have today and for many days seen our most cherished possessions torn from us and burned. We have witnessed the evil sight of uncouth men, driven on by a power-mad tyrant, persecuting our learned ones and destroying the accumulated wisdom of bygone ages. Now we are gathered here together to discuss how our heritage of written learning may be saved." He glanced shrewdly around as he continued, "Much has been lost. Much has been saved. Some of us, at risk of savage torture, substituted worthless papyri and saved the good that we have stored safely. Now, has anyone a suggestion that we may consider?" For some time, conversation ebbed and flowed in a muted undertone, as man debated with man the feasibility of this or that. At last, a young priest of the Temple of Upper Egypt stood up and in a different tone said, "Reverend sirs, I crave your indulgence for my temerity in addressing you thus." Heads nodded in encouragement, so he continued, "Last night, on duty in the temple, I dreamed. I dreamed that the god Bubastis descended before me and gave me indisputable instructions. I was to state that the ancient knowledge could be concealed by learned scribes distilling the wisdom of the ages, and then concealing that wisdom in the lines of carefully composed poems. This, said the god Bubastis, would be beyond the comprehension of the illiterate, but clearly apparent to the Illuminati. Thus posterity should not be deprived of our knowledge, nor of the knowledge that went before. Nervously he sat down. For moments there was silence as the elders debated within themselves. At last the Ancient One reached a decision. So be it, he said. We will conceal our knowledge in verse. We will also prepare special pictures of the Book of the Tarot, and we will make much that the pictures can be a card game, and in the fullness of time the light of knowledge shall shine forth again, replenished and renewed. Thus it came to pass as was ordained, and in the years that followed, men of high purpose and fearless of character strove to preserve all that which was worthy of preservation in verse and pictures, and the gods smiled, and they were content. Throughout the ages, mankind has used a special form of words that they might conceal and reveal at the same time. Verse can be used to enchant the reader or to mystify the intruder. By a suitable rhythm of verse, meter, rhyme, and all that sort of thing, one can delve down into the subconscious messages which one needs or requires to become part of one's psychic entity. When looking at a poem, one should decide whether the poet is just lightly playing with words or if he has some special message which he is trying to get over. Many times, a message which would be quite unacceptable in ordinary brutal prose can be so wrapped up that only the initiated can get the meaning. Many seers wrote their messages and predictions in verse, not because, as the skeptics say, they were afraid to put it in plain language, but so that those initiated in such things could read the deeper meaning behind the poem. Frequently, some illiterate author, and oh, what a lot of them there are, will attempt to sneer at famous poems of predictions. Of course, people who cannot write anything of their own can always get a market by pandering to the lower instincts of mankind, and so, as this is the age of Kali, everyone is trying to reduce everyone to a common denominator. This is the age of cynical disregard for the elementary precept that all men are not equal. No matter that they be equal in the sight of God, all men are not equal upon the earth. And there is a very prevalent form of inverted snobbery nowadays, which makes a man say, "Oh, I'm as good as he is." Now we see great leaders like Sir Winston Churchill or Roosevelt and others having their names and their reputations dragged in the mud, but only by the sorry little people who have no abilities of their own, and thus obtain a fiendish pleasure by trying to harm those who have abilities. Shall we look at a piece of poetry and then go deeper and look at the real meaning behind that poetry? Here, then, is a Tibetan poem, a very, very famous poem. It is not just pleasant reading, but it has special meaning attached to it. Here is the poem, "I Fear Not." In fear of death, I built a house, and my house is a house of the void of truth. Now I fear not death. In fear of cold, I bought a coat, and my coat is the coat of inner heat. Now I fear not cold. In fear of want, I sought wealth, and my wealth is glorious, unending sevenfold. Now I fear not want. In fear of hunger, I sought food, and my food is the food of meditation upon truth. Now I fear not hunger. In fear of thirst, I sought drink, and my drink is the nectar of right knowledge. Now I fear not thirst. In fear of weariness, I sought a companion, and my companion is the everlasting void of bliss. Now I fear not weariness. In fear of error, I sought a path, and my path is the path of transcendent union. Now I fear not error. I am a sage who possesses in plentitude the manifold treasures of desire, and wherever I dwell, I am happy. Shortly, we will delve down into the esoteric meaning of this poem, but first let us have another poem. Again, it's a Tibetan one. Again, this is one with very special meaning indeed. Here is the second poem called Be Content. Be Content. My son, as a monastery, be content with the body, for the bodily substance is the palace of divinity. As a teacher, be content with the mind, for knowledge of the truth is the beginning of holiness. As a book, be content with outward things, for their number is a symbol of the way of deliverance. As food, be content to feed on ecstasy, for stillness is the perfect likeness of divinity. As clothing, be content to put on the inner heat, for the sky-traveling goddesses wear the warmth of bliss. Companions, be content to forsake, for solitude is president of the divine assembly. Raging enemies, be content to shun, for enmity is a traveler upon the wrong path. With demons, be content to meditate upon the void, for magic apparitions are creations of the mind. Let us have yet one more poem, a Tibetan poem which was composed by the 6th Dalai Lama, a very erudite man indeed. He was a writer and an artist, a man misunderstood by many, but one who definitely left his mark upon Eastern culture. There are so few of his type in the world today. Here's a translation into English. I'm afraid I do not know who made the translation, but no matter who it was, the translation cannot in any way do justice to the actual thing in Tibetan. One of the great sorrows of authors is that translations into another language rarely follow the same trend of thought as that which the author attempted to impart in the original language. But here is this translation by someone unknown of My Love. My love, dear love, to whom my heart goes out, if we could but be wed, then had I gained the choicest gem from ocean's deepest bed. I chanced to pass my sweetheart fair upon the road one day, a turquoise found of clearest blue, found to be thrown away. High on the peach tree out of reach, the ripened fruit is there. So, too, the maid of noble birth, so full of life and fair. My heart's far off, the nights pass by in sleeplessness and strife. Even day brings not my heart's desire, for lifeless is my life. I dwell apart in Potala, a god on earth am I, but in the town the chief of rogues and boisterous revelry, it is not far that I shall roam. Lend me your wings, white crane, I go no farther than Li Tang, and thence return again. Now, let us consider the poem I Fear Not by that great man Milarepa. Milarepa wrote that the initiated may know certain things. Here is an inkling into the hidden meanings. In fear of death, I built a house, and my house is a house of the void of truth. Now I fear not death. The meaning of that has been variously translated and mistranslated. Actually, according to esoteric beliefs, it can be taken as meaning that even on other planes of existence, one cannot stand still on a tightrope. One must go forward or fall. One must progress upwards, or one must slip backwards. It is necessary at all times to keep in mind that although here we are upon earth, yet when we die, we are reborn into another stage of existence. When we finish with what we might term the earth stage of existence, we go on to another round where there are different abilities, different standards. For example, upon this particular cycle of lives, we are given so many senses. When we go to the next stage, we will have more senses, more abilities, and so on. But we move up, never backwards, unless it is by our own lack of energy. So, in fear of death, in the astral plane, I built a body, and my body had the emptiness of truth. With truth, I fear not death. In other words, we know that when we die to one life, we go on to the next. There is no such thing as permanent death. Death is rebirth. I want to tell you this in absolute sincerity. Because of very special training, I have been able to visit other planes of existence normally inaccessible to one, a dweller on this plane. Special precautions have to be taken by those who guide one, of course, because one's vibrations, and we are only vibrations, cannot unaided speed up to make it possible for us to reach those higher planes. The experience was quite painful. It was like a blinding light. It was like passing through white-hot flames. Yet, I was shielded and protected. I found that on a higher plane, I was of about the same standard as would be a slug on this earth, compared to a high human intelligence. The greatest scientists of this earth would find that they were no higher than that slug upon elevated planes. We have to progress all the time. And all the time, at the end of every life, we die, so-called, so that we can progress upwards. Think of a caterpillar. A caterpillar is a creature which crawls about, and then, apparently, it dies and becomes a butterfly, which moves in a different element, which moves in air instead of crawling about on the ground. Take the classic example of a dragonfly. From out of a stagnant pond, painfully crawls some lowly worm, some grub. It crawls slowly up, perhaps a rush or a projecting branch. It climbs up and takes a fierce, tenacious hold. Then there is no more movement and the creature dies, it seems, to decay. Eventually, from the dead husk, there comes a little plop, and the dead shell splits. From it emerges the dragonfly, limp, bedraggled, but it spreads its wings, and soon they become firm and iridescent. Then, with the sunlight upon it, the dragonfly rises up into the air and soars away. Now, isn't that really like humanity? The human body, something like a worm, you will agree, dies. From the dead husk emerges something which soars upward into a new life. That is what I like so much about dragonflies. They are a promise of eternal life. They are a promise that there's more than just this miserable flesh body. But I, for one, do not need promises, because I have experienced the actuality. If we were to continue with I fear not, we might go to, in fear of hunger, I sought food, and my food is the food of meditation upon truth. Now I fear not hunger. That, of course, means spiritual hunger, not physical, but spiritual. If a person is in doubt, he just doesn't know what to do or where to go to obtain knowledge. A person in doubt is a frustrated person, an unhappy person. In fear of spiritual hunger, I sought knowledge, and I meditated upon truth, and now, knowing the truth, I fear not hunger. I say to you that even in these humble little chapters, you can learn much. You can have seeds of knowledge planted within you. A seed is a small thing, but from a small seed can grow a mighty tree. I am trying to plant a seed. I am trying to light a candle in the darkness. Centuries ago, all mankind had knowledge such as this, but certain elements of mankind abused the knowledge, and so there came the Dark Ages, when the candles of learning throughout the world were extinguished, when man burned books of knowledge, and sank for a time into abysmal ignorance, when man was riddled with superstition. But now we are coming to a new era, to a new stage, wherein man is going to have additional powers. I may become unpopular when I say, almost in a whisper, atom bomb fallout may not be altogether the harmful thing with which it is so often supposed to be. Let us digress from poetry for a moment to get down to reality. Mankind, throughout the centuries, has been deteriorating. If we want to get prize cattle or prize animals, we do not let them mate indiscriminately and breed unfavorable strains. The animals are carefully picked and bred for quality, possibly for some particular quality. If we have trees, fruit trees, we can carefully tend those trees and graft them so that we get bigger and better fruit, or fruit having a special flavor. But let us neglect those animals, let them run wild. Let us desert our fruit groves and let them revert to nature. Then all the good training that they've had reverts back, and we get inferior fruit and inferior animals. Think, for instance, of a most beautiful apple which can revert back to a crab apple. Humans are like crab apples. Humans breed indiscriminately, and people with the least desirable traits usually have the most children, while people who have knowledge or characters which could actually increase the quality of the human race have no children at all. Oftentimes, it is because of excessive taxation or excessive import duties. So possibly, old Mother Nature, who must know a thing or two after all these years, might see a different way of increasing the value of the human race. Give this a thought. Possibly, Old Mother Nature has made it so that a few strange radiations are let loose to produce mutations. Not all mutations are bad, you know. We get, for instance, a germ, a family of germs. They are treated by penicillin. Many get killed off, but others change. They become immune to penicillin. Later, they become not just immune, but they thrive on penicillin. How do we know that humans are not doing the same? Always, we have to move upwards. Always, we have to progress. And it is my firm belief, which also is a belief of Eastern thought, that everyone has to know all these things before they can pass on to higher stages of evolution. In fear of error, I sought a path, and my path is the path of transcendent union. Now I fear not error. In other words, I did not know which way to move. I did not know where my path lay, so I sought knowledge from higher worlds. I got that knowledge, and now I do not fear that I am making a mistake of my life. I am a sage who possesses in plentitude the manifold treasures of desire, and wherever I dwell, I am happy. Again, I am wise that I have obtained from other sources knowledge of what is to be, knowing what one is required to know. Thus, knowing that life upon earth is, in the infinity of man's spiritual lifetime, just a flickering of an eyelid, I can be contented wherever I dwell. Thus, I fear not. Milarepa was a great sage. He was a man who retired into a mountain cave. People came to consult him and to study with him. Let me make it clear that those who came to study with him attended to his body wants, cleaned his cave, looked after his clothing, prepared his meal, ran his messages. So many people of the West think, oh, all the knowledge should be free. You must not charge to teach people anything. But of course, that's just ignorance. It's asinine, crass ignorance. That is said by people with little knowledge, and little knowledge is a dangerous thing indeed. Anything that is worth having is worth working for. Milarepa taught that one must be content with knowledge. Milarepa taught that the body was as a monastery, and the monks within the monastery were the different powers and abilities of the body and of the mind. For the bodily substance is the palace of divinity. Again, the body substance, the flesh or clay or whatever you want to call your body, is the house wherein dwells the overself, or the soul, who is here upon this earth to gain experience of mundane things. In higher stages of existence, one cannot meet those whom one heartily dislikes. The obvious answer is to come to earth where you meet all of them, all the time. You just think. If you really think with an open mind, you will find that you dislike an amazing number of people, and you're sure that an even greater number of people dislike you. If you're honest, you'll agree that that is right. If you go to work, you'll be sure that somebody is trying to cut you out of your job. Somebody's trying to deny you promotion. Somebody has a spite against you. Well, that's so, isn't it? Well, The Oversolve has to come to Earth to get those obnoxious experiences. Thus it is that the body is a fairly durable contraption. It houses the soul against undue shocks. One must be content with the mind, because within the mind you can store and sort out the knowledge of truth. And until you know the truth, you cannot know holiness. Holiness, not in the sanctimonious sense, but in the true sense, which recognizes that the Oversolve is the controller of the body, and the body is merely a puppet. Milarepa goes on, "Raging enemies, be content to shun, for enmity is a traveler upon the wrong path." That means you must not have hatred or enmity for anyone, because if you feel strong hatred for anyone, it means that you are upon the wrong path. You cannot stand still on a tightrope. You either go forward or you go back, because actually, you know, on our spiritual tightrope, you cannot fall off and be destroyed. Often in religions, in all religions, there is a talk of eternal damnation, a talk of eternal torment. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. These things were said by the priests of old in the same way that mother might tell her child, "Now you be quiet or I'll tell your father. He'll take a stick to you." In the days of old, people were very much like children. They perhaps lacked reasoning power, which has developed throughout the ages. Often they had to be threatened in order to help them. You might find that little Joe or Charlie won't eat his breakfast, and you might say, if you're foolish, "Now you eat this up this moment or I'll call the policeman for you." I have known that to happen many times. Well, eventually little Joe or little Charlie thinks that all policemen are fiends. He thinks that a policeman's always ready to pounce upon him or take him off to jail and do all kinds of unmentionable things to him forever and ever and a bit longer. So in the days gone by, the priests used to say, "Ah, the devils will get at you. Devils will prod you in various unmentionable places. They will give you, in fact, the devil of a time." Don't believe it. There is a God. It does not matter what you're going to call that God. There is a God of good, and no person is ever called upon to suffer beyond his limits. Some of you, though, have memories of other things. Some of us, as in my own case, have actual knowledge, not just memories. And some people, without the memories and without the knowledge, are called upon to suffer more than they need to suffer because they will not learn by lessons of the past. We live upon this earth. We are, as you know, about 9/10 subconscious. 1/10 of us only is conscious, or at least that's the popular figure. By the sight of some of the people on certain other continents, one would doubt that people are even 1/10 conscious. But I want to say something here about other work which is done by the Oversolve. The Oversolve, of course, is 10/10 conscious. It has to be, otherwise the human subconscious could not be 9/10 awake. The Oversolve is not confined to dealing with one body alone. There are different systems of utilizing the energies of the Oversolve, and let us just briefly look at them. Some people come as a member of a group, for example, A young girl may be upon the earth, and she may be quite lost and inept without the company of her brothers, her sisters, and her parents. These people, they seem to function only when they are all together. Death makes a terrific gap, while when one gets married, then the married person is always running back to the family. These people may be as puppets, all controlled by the same over-self. Twins or quads often also are controlled by the same over-self. It seems as if the leaders of other planes know that this particular round of existence is nearly at an end and another will start, and so they seem to be bringing people here to work in groups under the control of one over-self to each group, in much the same way as a communistic dictatorship has cells of so many people under the control of one supervisor, and all the supervisors are under the control of a senior supervisor, and so on. One has often seen groups of birds, perhaps 50 birds, wheeling and turning in unison as if under the command of one person. Well, that is as it should be, because these birds are all controlled by one person, in just the same way as a colony of ants is controlled by one over-self, or a hive of bees is controlled by one over-self. People who are more enlightened, more evolved, have a different system, and this is going to make you think. So let us take it slowly and briefly, because, actually, all we have to bother about is how we are managing on this earth. Let the other worlds take care of themselves until we can get around to them. There are many different worlds like the earth, not in the same, for want of a better word I can only call time, but perhaps we should do better if we use a musical term, harmonics. We can have a musical note, a pure note, but then fundamentals of the original note. In much the same way, there is this earth, which perhaps we should call Earth D, then there are Earths C, B, A, and E, F, G, for instance. There are similar Earths, similar worlds, and they are called parallel universes, or parallel worlds, whichever you prefer. An over-self who has evolved and who realizes that controlling just one puny little earth body is time-consuming and not sufficiently educational can have a puppet on each of several worlds. So that in world A, for example, little Benny can be a genius, but in world F, little Freddy can be a moron. In that way, the over-self can see two sides of the coin at once, and can gain experience on both ends of the scale. A really experienced over-self might have 9 different puppets, and that is the same as living 9 different lives, which speeds up evolution quite a bit. But this subject has already been dealt with more fully in Chapter 2. As was stated at the beginning of this chapter, poetry or verse or a definite rhythm pattern is often used to drive a matter deeply into one's subconscious. Now, we're going to have an example of the type of thing which the Egyptians used to do. Unfortunately, it loses a lot of its power in translation into English. In the original Egyptian, the words swayed rhythmically and achieved the desired purpose, but Just think for yourself. If you get a piece of poetry and you translate it from English or Spanish into, let us say, German, you get the sounds all wrong. You get the balances all wrong, and so it does not have the same effect. In fact, some poems cannot be translated at all into another language. So this confession to Matt is not as good as it would be if it were in Egyptian. This is a temple confession, which was said in the chamber of Matt in the Egyptian temple of initiation. It is written in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. It was actually an invocation. Mat, you may remember, is the Egyptian word meaning truth. So the chamber of Mat becomes the chamber or temple of truth. Here is the confession to Mat, which should be repeated every night before one goes to sleep. If one repeats this, as did the Egyptians, then it leads one to a much purer life. Try it and see. The Confession to Mat. Homage to thee, O great God, thou master of all truth. I have come to thee, O my God, and have brought myself hither, that I may become conscious of thy decrees. I know thee, and am attuned with thee, and thy 42 laws which exist with thee in this chamber of Mat. In truth I come into thy attunement, and I have brought Mat in my mind and soul. I have destroyed wickedness for thee. I have not done evil to mankind. I have not oppressed the members of my family. I have not wrought evil of right and truth. I have no intimacy with worthless men. I have not demanded first consideration. I have not decreed that excessive labor be performed for me. I have not brought forward my name for exaltation to honors. I have not defrauded the oppressed of property. I have made no man suffer hunger. I have made no one weep. I have caused no pain to be inflicted upon man or animal. I have not defrauded the temple of their oblations. I have not diminished from the bushel. I have not filched away land. I have not encroached upon the fields of others. I have not added to the weights of the scales to cheat the seller, and I have not misread the pointer of the scales to cheat the buyer. I have not kept milk from the mouths of children. I have not turned back the water at the time it should flow. I have not extinguished the fire when it should burn. I have not repulsed God in his manifestation. I am pure. I am pure. I am pure. My purity is the purity of the divinity of the holy temple. Therefore, evil shall not befall me in this world, because I know the laws of God, which are God. There are, as previously stated, occasions when prose in special form is used to drive into the subconsciousness a special message. Here is a prayer which I composed and which you should repeat 3 times each morning. To my over-self I pray. Let me this day, living my life day by day in the manner prescribed, control and direct my imagination. Let me this day, living my life day by day in the manner prescribed, control my desires and my thoughts, that I may be purified. Let me this day and all days keep my imagination and my thoughts directed firmly upon the task which has to be accomplished, that success may come thereby. I will at all times live my life day by day, controlling imagination and thought. You should also have a prayer to be said at night, 3 times each night before going to sleep. Here, then, is a specially composed prayer, composed by me, which will instill discipline into your subconscious by night. A prayer. Keep me free from evil thoughts. Keep me free from the blackness of despair. At the time of my misery, shine a light into the darkness that enshrouds me. Let my every thought be good and clean. Let my every action be for the good of others. Let me be positive in my thoughts, that my mind may be strengthened therefrom. I am the master of my destiny. As I think today, so am I tomorrow. Let me therefore avoid all evil thoughts. Let me avoid all thoughts which cause distress to others. Let my spirit arise within me, that I may easily succeed in the task that lies ahead. I am the master of my destiny. So be it. End of chapter 5.